This is a recording of three AA speakers recorded on January 6, 1990 at the Visalia Lano Club. Please observe the anonymity of all AA speakers. Thank you.
Jump up and down here anymore. We're very fortunate tonight to have three speakers. Our first one is going to be our own Wanda V, because she has a really lively story, to say the least. And she's a real attention grabber. I'm not going to say any more. Our second speaker, and where is he, is Earl Lyle from Bakersfield. Where is he? There he is. And I've heard him before, and he's excellent. And our third speaker is Ed Palmquist from Kingsburg, who I met a couple years ago going down to Kingsburg meeting. These people could all talk for 3 hours each. So we're really forcing them to do something very difficult and keep it to about 20, 25 minutes each. Wanda's going to speak first, and after she speaks, if you'd like to get up and take a 10-minute R&R break, beat it to the bathroom in the coffee pot, that would be wonderful, and then sit back down, and we'll go on to Earl, and then on to Ed last. At the end of the meeting, we're going to have a very short, and I emphasize very short, GSR report, because we need to take a vote on something very important, and Margie's asked me about that. And when we're done with that, we will finish with the Lord's Prayer. And would you do that for us? Okay. And I neglected to do the most important thing, and that's to start this thing with the Serenity Prayer. So it's never too late to pray. So let's do good luck to Wanda.
Which one of these is working? Well, my name is Wanda, and I am an alcoholic. And I've been a bit nervous about this, but I'm sure I'll be all right after I get going. I've had a cold, too, so if I break into a coughing spasm, you'll have to excuse me. How's the volume? Is it okay? Okay. Well, I'm going to share a little bit about where I came from, what happened, and what it's like today. And I've been thinking about this all week because I think that's what we do. You tell us we're going to speak and what we think about, what we're going to say. So I've been kind of running things around my head, and I've been nervous, and I thought, well, maybe I'll just get up there and say whatever's on the top of my head. But I decided on a few little points I would bring out about my story. Because like Linda said, I could probably speak for 3 hours. Anyway, I started drinking when I was about 15 years old. I'm 32 now, and I've been sober a little over 9 years. And when I was 18, this story comes to mind, this particular point. I had come to a place where I came to in this room. Now, this room was on the top floor of one of these old junky buildings in the downtown area of Kalamazoo, Michigan, where I was raised. I don't recall what was underneath these rooms. I don't know what was downstairs. But I know I was at the end of the hall, and it had one bathroom for the whole hallway. Some of you have probably been in these places too. And I opened my eyes, this one morning stands out to me vividly, and I looked around the room, I was alone, and the bed had those little bed springs, no box springs, you know, the kind with the bed springs and the little iron thing that had been painted 15 colors over the years. You see the little chips in there? And I look around this room, and there's this little nightstand there, and it's got about a million cigarette burns on it, and the paint's falling off the walls. And I look around, and I think to myself, I'm 18 years old. I think, how did I get here? How did I come to this place in my life that was so worthless? You know, I couldn't understand it. I craved. I wanted to go home. I wanted to get in my little twin bed that had the little white headboard with the gold buttons and the white bedspread. That's where I wanted to be. and I didn't know how I got from there to this place. I couldn't understand it. I mean, I was a middle class child, and so I thought, and I couldn't understand how I got to this place. Well, that was when I was 18 years old. And since I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous until a couple weeks before my 23rd birthday, things got worse in between those years. Well, from 18 to 23, things went downhill. There came a time when there was no room. We progressed. There was a car to sleep in. That's okay, I can live with that. Go to the park, you know, hang out at the park, drive the car around, drink, do this, do that. Well, as time went on, the car was removed. There was no car. So then you're on foot, you know, and then I still would wonder to myself, how did I get to this place? I couldn't understand it. I didn't know that I was an alcoholic. I thought that I had just had bad luck, perhaps. Maybe I was insane, perhaps. Those thoughts crossed my mind. And during this time, I have to throw a few things in here. When I was 19, I ended up in a mental institution. And when I got to the mental institution, I couldn't walk because I was incapacitated, to say the least. So they put me in the room with the real bad cases and they brought the food in there. And I thought, how did I get here? Then one of the attendants was a neighbor of my parents. I was so humiliated. And I didn't have any answer for that. How did I get there? Well, I don't know. So I went along, I got out of there, went along, and I went to jail in Detroit. That was an experience for a young woman of my background. To be in jail in Detroit was quite an experience. And again, I asked myself, how does this happen? I don't understand this. I must be missing something here. I'm missing the point. I'm not getting it. And I couldn't get it. I just couldn't get it, you know. And I never owned a home. I owned a few cars. But I don't know if anybody can relate to this, but you know, you get a perfectly good automobile, and then in a few months down the road, you know, the driver's door is wired together with bathing wire, and you gotta crawl through the passenger side, and then the heater goes out, and you gotta go down to the junkyard and buy those $2 used tires and hope that they last for a few miles. You know, so that's where alcohol took me. Those are some of the places that alcohol took me. And I could never figure it out. I just couldn't figure it out. I had gone to therapy and counselors at school. Everybody was concerned with my well-being because I did demonstrate some bizarre behavior. But nonetheless, I decided that I had an opportunity to come to California with this truck driver. And he required nothing of me. And I said, well, I don't have any money. He said, it's okay, I don't need any money. I said, good, great. We got a deal. So I decided I would come to California and start anew. Start fresh, because after all, it had to be Michigan that was my problem. You know, because it had to be. So I get to California, and I see all these palm trees and orange trees. And I was just amazed. I had never seen an orange on a tree in my whole life. And I thought, this is it, boy. This is paradise. I got it now. So I'm out here in California thinking everything's going to be fine. I'm going to pull myself together. I'm going to get a job. I'm going to do everything right. I'm going to do it all right. Because up to all these years to this point, I thought I was wrong. I didn't think of myself as being sick. I thought of myself as being wrong. I was a worthless human being who couldn't make the right decisions at any time. So, why try? I mean, when you got that to live with, I couldn't really see any point in trying. So I didn't, because there was no hope. So I came to California, and I was 20 years old. The drinking age in California at the time was 21. I was unaccustomed to this law. Because in Michigan, the legal drinking age had been 18, which suited me just fine, because at 16, I looked quite old. So there was no problem. But I come to California with all the palm trees and the orange trees and the 21-year-old drinking age. I think, well, what would a person do that wants something to drink? Well, the person would go to the liquor store. And if the person couldn't buy anything on their own, they would ask someone who was going in there. Good idea. So, this was probably a week after I got here. I had not been abstinent in that week, so don't get the wrong idea. But I wanted to go down here and get something to drink, because I had some serious catching up to do. This guy I was with, he didn't drink, but he liked other stuff. Okay, enough of that. So, I go to the liquor store, and this poor little man, he was going in, and I said, excuse me, would you please buy me a six-pack of beer? He says, well, honey, I don't have any money. I said, that's okay, I have money. He said, well, I guess so. I said, okay, while you're in there, would you please get a fifth of gin, too? That's how I drank, okay? It worked. So I went along, and I did get a job here. I did get this car. I didn't run very good. But I got a job, and I got a car. And I had a place to live. And I still wasn't okay. What's wrong with me? I don't know. It must be that asshole I live with. Well, we'll get rid of him, right? So I got rid of him. Still, what's wrong with me? I don't know. I couldn't figure it out. I had these two little babies. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I got rid of the asshole because he was my problem. I'm sure of it. So I think, okay, I've got it now. I'm going to go to Al-Anon. Because my father's an alcoholic and the girl down the street is. So, I'm going to Al-Anon. At the same time, I'm going to church. And I'm also going to a psychologist, because there's something wrong. I don't know what it is. So, at church, God talked to me. At Al-Anon, the ladies looked at me rather strangely. At the psychologist, he set my appointment at 8 o'clock in the morning because he said he couldn't help me if I didn't come in straight. Well, what kind of psychologist are you? They couldn't help me. What's wrong with me now? What am I going to do? They can't help me. These professional people, this God that's supposed to be super, can't help me. And these poor little children, these twin little babies, they're looking to me for nurturing, for feeding, for bathing, for taking care of. I don't know what's wrong. What am I going to do? I don't know what to do. I've got it. I find the answer. I decide I need a boyfriend. It'll work. So, I start dating this guy from AA. Yeah. I start dating this guy from AA. So, it was great. He went to the AA meeting. I went to the Al-Anon meeting. We went home. I got high. He went home. Okay? So, one evening, we're at this dual meeting. I'm in one room at the Al-Anon meeting. This other person's in the other room at the AA meeting. And I think, well, this hour meeting is over. I think I'll just wander in there. see what they're doing. So I wander into this AA meeting over here at Pine Recovery, and this young lady was talking. She was 16 years old, or 15, maybe she was 15, very young, and she was chairing the meeting, and she was talking about these feelings, and I could feel it. Right here, you know where it hurts? I could feel it. I thought to myself, well, it's time to go home now. So I left. But at that moment, I had that feeling, and I didn't really like it. It was kind of uncomfortable. So I didn't bounce right back down here to AA the next day and profess my willingness to be an alcoholic and be sober. It took me a little while. But I ended up going down to Pine, to one of those meetings, and telling them that I was an alcoholic. Now, when I first said it, I really didn't believe it, because that surely to God couldn't be it. But there was no hope anyplace else. God had not been able to help me. The psychologist had not been able to help me. Al-Anon had not been able to help me. The boyfriend had not been able to help me. The kids certainly couldn't help me. So what have I got to lose at this point? I'll just go down there and tell them I'm an alcoholic, and maybe they'll let me hang around long enough. Maybe something will happen. So I hear in these meetings, they say, if you don't believe it in your innermost self, then you're not in the right place. I went, oh my God, what will I do? Somebody's going to find out that I really don't believe in my heart that I'm an alcoholic. What will I go? To alleviate that problem, I got myself a book, and I went to reading that book, and I was quoting stuff and going to every meeting I could get myself to out of fear. Fear. There was nothing else but fear. And so I would go to these meetings, and I would listen, and occasionally at a time when I got to where I would talk quite a bit. But I was motivated by fear in the beginning, because I didn't want you people to find out the real me. Because I had been kicked out of school. I had been kicked out of everything that you can imagine being kicked out of. I had been kicked out of it. And this was, even if I wasn't an alcoholic, this was my last hope, because I thought, maybe they won't kick me out of this. You know, maybe I can make some friends. Maybe I can belong to something, because I don't want to be alone anymore. So I kept coming, and I came long enough. I listened long enough. I read my book. I got a sponsor. I did what they told me to do out of fear, because I was afraid if I didn't do it, then I would be kicked out. I would not be accepted. I would not have friends. So through all this, keep coming back, through all this, I came to believe in my innermost self that I am an alcoholic. And that's been the problem all along. It just dawned on me. That was it. That was the problem all along. And being in this program has been an experience in itself. I have come so far. I have come such a long way. You know, my children were just short of 1 year old when I got sober. And those children have never had to see their mother drunk. You know, and to me, that is worth everything. Because when I came here, I had such a conflict inside of me. I wanted to be a mother, and I couldn't. I didn't know how. And I couldn't be a drunk and a mother at the same time. And I wanted to be a mother. I didn't realize that then. I've come to realize that now. And now I have been able to be a good mother. I mean, I go down there to school, and I have conference, and I even request conference with the principal. You know, and they don't throw me out. They listen. I am able to effectively communicate with people from all walks of life and all levels in our society. I no longer walk in fear. I no longer have the problem of feeling lesser than, because I don't feel that today because of this program, working these steps, you know. And this program has been very, very good to me. very good to me. The people in it have been good to me. God has been good to me. The God I thought couldn't help me, He's been good to me. And I'm very thankful for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope that in the little things that I do day to day, I have high hope that some of those things are helping other people. Because in my daily prayers, I pray that God will work through me to help others. Now, there have been many occasions when I've questioned the sanity of that prayer. Because when you pray to help others, you really have to do it. And it can be tiring at times, you know. But it's important because so many people helped me along the way. In the beginning, I had no car. I had no friends. I had nothing. And people were willing to come to my house and visit and talk and give me rides and give me work. They gave me work so I could make money, you know. And I have to be willing in turn to do what I can for other people. And sometimes I feel like I fall short of that, but sometimes I feel okay with it. So all in all, I'm okay today. And I thank all of you for being here and being part of my recovery and for listening to me so attentively. I can see it. And thank you. And I think my time is up. So thank you all. That's it. I believe our hostess, aren't we having a break now?
Up here and let him do his thing, and then following that we'll have Ed. I'm also going to pass around.
You're a beautiful bunch of sick people. I'm not a lot of an alcoholic. I want to recognize those people on the new board, and I'm not sure which word to use, whether it's congratulations or condolences. It's one of the two. I've served on the board of Alana Club, and I was the chairman of the board for a couple of years. So I know, I've had that experience. I love all of you. And I couldn't say that when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to congratulate Wanda, the speaker that was up here before me. She's in that beautiful spot of sobriety, and she's got a long ways to go, I hope. She's been sober longer than she drank. And I don't think I'll ever make that. Because I started drinking at about 8 or 9. I drank for 40 years, and I've been sober now nearly 13. So if I'm going to be an old, old man if I ever get to that point where I'm sober longer than I drank. It would be nice. It's pretty nice today. I'm not going to talk to you a lot about drinking. I'm sure most of you, if you're here and have been here any length of time, know a little bit about drinking. I particularly want to say hello to any newcomers that might be here tonight. Don't worry about whether you're alcoholic or not. It doesn't say anything in the book or anything in any AA literature anywhere where you have to be an alcoholic to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. And that's it. That's the bottom line. And if you're new or relatively new, you probably don't know whether you want to stop drinking or not. It doesn't matter. Just keep coming back long enough, and you might find out. I was not an alcoholic when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I might admit, if I was pressed real hard, to admit that I drank a little bit too much sometimes at the wrong time. But I definitely was not an alcoholic. I became alcoholic from sitting in rooms like this with people like you. And so I'm convinced today that alcoholism is seriously contagious. See, you get it in rooms like this. I remember the day that I said, I'm real Lyle, I'm alcoholic. I was 8 or 9 or 10 months sober, I'm not sure. But I remember the incident. I was at a noon meeting in Fellowship Hall. It's a little club similar to this on Lower State Street in Santa Barbara. I was down there at a noon meeting. I said, I'm real Lyle, I'm an alcoholic. And I knew without a doubt the argument was over. I didn't debate with myself anymore. From that day on, I have been convinced and have stayed convinced that I'm a real alcoholic. I'm going to tell you just enough about my drinking to let you know that I belong here, if some of you have any doubts. I'm not going to get into a drunk log because, as I said before, if you're here, you know what drinking is about, and some of you may have been quite more adept at it than I was. But I drank my 40 barrels. I did not get in trouble every time I drank, nor did I get drunk every time I drank. But I can assure you this, every time I got in serious trouble, I've been drinking. Now, a lot of people, you know, they get drunk and beat up on a lot of people, and I never did beat up on anybody, but I got the shit beat out of me many times as a result of alcohol. I never was very big. The only fight I ever won, was the guy slipped going around the corner. And I was able to get away from him completely. I did all the things that anybody else did. You know, I would go home and fight with my dad. I always ran back home whenever I got in trouble, and my dad would always let me stay there, and my parents, until finally one day I got home and we had gotten in an awful argument, and he asked me to leave, and I thought it was the most unhuman thing he could have ever done because I was only 27. But I had to get out on my own, so I picked a young little innocent farm girl to marry. And from that marriage was 5 children. And they were raised in an alcoholic home, and they show the effects of it today. The baby of that marriage is living in Bakersfield. The rest of them are scattered all across the country. 4 out of the 5 are drug abusers. The baby in Bakersfield went to treatment down there 3 years ago, and she hasn't been able to stay sober yet. She calls me frequently. You know, she was over. Her and her live-in boyfriend were over to our house New Year's Day, and we had a big supper, a big dinner, and watched TV. Before I get too far down the line, there's a lady here tonight that a lot of you know me, but I'd like Bernice to stand up. I want you to meet the lady that puts up with me on a daily basis. Bernice, will you stand up? She's also one of us. Her and I met on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and when we were to get married, my sponsor was the kindest one in town. He gave it 30 days. If nothing serious happens for the next 60 days, we'll have been married 11 years. So, Alcoholics Anonymous works. I spent a lot of time in the Air Force. In fact, I retired from the United States Air Force 20 years ago. And through that period, I did a lot of drinking, you know. And there were periods where I would get along quite well for 3 or 4 months, or maybe a year, and then I'd go on a terrible binge. And it just kept getting worse and worse. And finally, towards the end of my Air Force career, they sent me to Southeast Asia, and I proceeded to get in serious trouble over there drinking. I came back from Southeast Asia in the early of 1969. My then wife, my first wife and children were living in Omaha, and I had only been home about 3 or 4 days, and she said, "We're going to have a little conference," and I could tell by the look on her face and the tone of her voice that it was going to be not to my liking. And it was very shortly into the conversation, she says, "We're going to split the house." She got the inside and I got the outside. And from there, the conversation went to pot. So I was asked to pack my bags and leave, and I got my assignment. My assignment was to California, Vandenberg Air Force Base, and I came out here on my own. I'd only been here a short time, and the drinking was getting heavy and heavy. One Friday, I had a pretty good job then. I've always been real fortunate. God's been good to me all my life, and I just didn't realize it. But I had taken off early on a Friday afternoon and went over to the club and got real polluted and decided, you know, the brilliant mind of an alcoholic, I ought to go up to San Jose and see my brother. So I got in my little car and headed up 101, and I got to Santa Maria and stopped in the outpost and had a few. And coming out of the outpost, I smacked a couple of cars and wrecked the headlights on mine, but I decided to go on anyway. I didn't tell anybody. Got just about to Los Osos, and the CHP pulled me over. They could not believe that I had been driving, you know, on 101 from Vandenberg. I couldn't even stand up out on the highway. So they locked me up and don't ever go over to San Luis Obispo County Jail unless it's improved a lot. That's the worst place I've ever been. But I was scheduled for a court appearance in about 3 weeks, and so when I got back, I told my boss that I was going to have to go to court, that I had gotten one of those DWI, as they call them, or DUI. But I thought, well, I'll fix them, you know. I bought a new uniform and put all the ribbons on it, you know, about 4 rows of ribbons, and a new hat and a haircut and a new pair of shoes. And my thinking was that nobody in their right mind would lock up a fine, upstanding NCO, you know, dressed like that. So I'm sitting over there in the courthouse in San Luis Obispo, and the judge walked in with a seeing eye dog. And I thought that's the end of the line. But again, God takes care of junks and little babies, and all I had to do was submit a letter to the probation officer once a month for 12 months, and that was it. No fine or anything else. So it wasn't long, and I retired from there. Of course, they were getting hot on my tail, and I thought I better retire. And so I got out and started drawing my little Air Force retirement and working in a bar over in Vilton, living in this beautiful life, you know. And in November of that year, I started working for the post office, and that went well for a while. I'd get in a little trouble, but the vision was getting worse. And finally, one day, I was AWOL for 3 days, and I finally called the postmaster and I said, your job is interfering with my drinking. I'm going to have to resign. He assured me that I was insane, and I said, no, I just better get out. And so I resigned and went on a bender and ended up in jail when I came to. Before I went to jail, I'd signed a power of attorney to my son. He lived in Lompoc at the time. So I'm in jail one day. You know, everything was gone. My family was gone. The car was gone. The job was gone. The money was gone. I just found out that day that my son had spent my retirement, my federal retirement. And I'm laying there in the bunk, and I look up and I say, why me, God? And the answer came, so there's something about you, Earl, that just pisses me off. That was the way I had always prayed all my life. It wasn't long after that I was released from jail, and immediately got drunk. I drank for a couple of weeks, and one night I got that little Air Force retirement check and went down to the bar and cashed it and drank it up. And it was somewhere around midnight or maybe after, and I'm there drunk. I don't know why I remember this today. But one of those cops walked in, and he knew me and I knew him, and I was still on probation. I wasn't supposed to be there. And he turned around, he did what he had to do, and turned around and walked out. I just slumped over the bar in total relief, and I said the first prayer I ever said in my life, I'm sure sincerely, and it was very simple. I said, God, do I have to live this way the rest of my life? And the answer came quite naturally, that no, I didn't. And I pushed the drink back on the bar and got up and walked out. I have not had to have a drink since that day. That was the 1st of April in 1977. As part of my sentence, I was to go to and into Alcoholics Anonymous. So on a Sunday morning, about 10 days later, I went to my first AA meeting this time. I had been to AA in 1975, but it didn't do any good. I went to that first meeting on East Ocean in Lompoc, California, at 11 o'clock one Sunday morning. I remember the gal that led the meeting, and there were about 13 or 14 people there. Two people by the name of Dick J. and Bob B. after the meeting come over and put their arms around me and said, we love you. We're glad you're back. We wondered when you'd make it. And I got involved in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Dick J. was a member of Hospital Institutions Committee in the Central Coast in Santa Barbara. And he got me involved, and I started doing things for other people. And I can tell you this, that being involved in this club or any other work that you can do in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is going to be to your benefit as long as you are actually trying to help somebody else. You know, we always have beautiful motives when we come in here and think we're going to do so much good for everybody. And the one we really help is ourselves. You know, our problem never was alcohol. My problem was not alcohol. My problem was alcoholism. I didn't get it without drinking. I do not believe that you can get alcoholism without drinking alcohol. You can have all the symptoms and everything else, but we have an obsession of the mind and an allergy of the body. And it says in our book that we are bodily and mentally different from our fellows. Don't ever forget that. We are. But I learned to read that book that told me that. There's four things that we tell everybody when they're new here. You don't drink, you read the book, you get a sponsor, and you go to meetings, meetings, meetings. And if you're slacking any one of those four, you're probably going to drink again. This is where it is, these meetings. I know people that quit going to meetings and quit being involved, and they get drunk again. The most glaring example I know of is the father of AA in Bakersfield. When I got to Bakersfield in 1980, he was still actively involved in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And shortly after that, several things happened in his family, several things happened in his life, and he was physical health started to deteriorate. He quit being involved. He had been sober 39 and a half years when he started drinking because he quit being involved with you people. And that's sad to have to say that, but that's exactly what happens. There was a saying early in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous way back. Them that don't go to meetings don't get to hear what happens to them that don't go to meetings. And it's that simple. I started reading the book, and you know, we read chapter 3 tonight. I do a lot of sponsoring of newcomers in Alcoholics Anonymous and some old-timers. I sponsor a couple people down in Bakersfield. One of them is going to have 37 years this month. I think Dottie ordered me a medallion that I'll have to pick up from her and present to him in a couple, 3 weeks. Another one over 30 years. And sponsorship to me is friendship back and forth. I help them and they help me. I really believe when that old man asked me to be his sponsor, he really had in mind, he said, "You sick bastard, you need a sponsor, and I think I'm going to be it." But we had a good time. But every newcomer that I sponsor, I tell them two things. They always start worrying about the steps, and I said, "Don't worry about the steps. Start reading the book, and particularly chapters 3 and 4. We read chapter part of chapter 3 tonight. And in there it says, where we read, we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. And that whole chapter, chapter 3, more about alcoholism, covers what I believe is the groundwork for step 1 of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Step 2 comes in chapter 4, the agnostic, to the agnostic, or we agnostic. And in there, at the start of the chapter, it says, lack of power was our dilemma. We needed to find a power greater than ourselves that would restore us to sanity. And that's the main object of this book. That's what this book is all about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. And later on it tells you on page 55 where you'll find that. It says everybody is born with an innate belief in spirituality and a belief in a higher power. Sometimes we have to search long and hard to get there, but we will always find it because it's deep down within us. And in the final analysis, it's only where it can be found. And when you find that higher power deep down within you, you've taken step 2. And then the book moves on into the program, how it works, chapter 5. And when we get done reading there on page 60, where it says the ABCs, the very next sentence is being convinced we're now alcohol, we're now at step 3. And then it goes on to step 3 prayer on page 63 and on through the rest of it. And the rest of chapter 5 deals with step 3 and 4. And chapter 6 into action covers step 5 through 11. Many of them are very easily touched on, and then chapter 7, working with others, deals solely with step 12. And step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and apply these principles in all our affairs. The message is that AA works. We're sober. And that's the message we carry. Doesn't make any difference what we say. You can't talk to a drunk and convince him that it works. What you have to do is live the life of sobriety and show them that it works. And that's the only way they learn. And then we try to practice these principles. What principles? I was about 8 or 9 years sober before I discovered that there's a principle attached to each one of those previous 11 steps. And a group in Florida came out with a word for those, and my wife put them down in her book, and I got a hold of it one day, and I copied those, and I said, oh, that's what they were talking about. So we try to practice those principles in all our affairs, and that's exactly what it means, all our affairs. You know, we can't be promiscuous, we can't be adulterous, we can't, you know, when I was drinking, I used to find a lot of things that weren't lost. I don't do that anymore. I'm truthful to Bernice as much as I can be. You know, I have not had to go to bed with another woman. Any of those things, those principles outline those things that we're supposed to practice. Chuck Tamlin said in that tape that he made in Palo Mesa in 1975, you can't think your way into proper living, you have to live your way into proper thinking. We're going to think the way we live. And if you're still living like a rotten SOB, that's the way you're going to think. But if you get your act together and start living the way God meant for you to be, the thinking will come around and you'll start acting like you talk. Walking like you talk, and that's the name of the game. I hope that I can do that. Some days I can, some days I can't. But I'm always striving. I'll never be an angel in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I can assure you I'm a lot better today than I was when I started. I'm going to tell you, you know, those five children I raised, I had my oldest daughter did not speak to me for something over 10 years. She had no claim on me as a father whatsoever, and the others weren't much better. 1984, my father died. And I was back to the funeral, and I rode out to the cemetery with another in one car, but I had to ride back to town with my daughter and her husband. And we were able to talk. And a few months after that, she gave birth to one of my granddaughters, and she called me on the phone and told me. I was one of the first persons she called. And she says, "Dad, why does it have to take so long?" And I said, "I don't know, honey." And today we're on the best of terms. And Bernice and I were there this summer and stayed with her for a couple of nights. And when we drove away from her driveway that morning, she just about broke down. There were tears in her eyes because she didn't want us to leave. And she didn't like the idea of us living 2,000 miles apart. Another daughter, the next to the youngest daughter, went through treatment in 1982. She lives in Orlando, Florida. She called me the other day. She's going to pay Bernice and I a flight down to Orlando the first week of February to see a grandson that I haven't seen yet. And I think she's got her act together. But when we talk today on the phone, we're able to tell each other that we love one another. That was never done in our family when I was drinking. Never, ever. I'm so very, very fortunate to be a product of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was fortunate enough to be sober for 7 years before my dad died, 9 years before my mother died. And if they were to be here tonight, I believe that they would commend all of you for being a part of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and being a part of me getting my act together so I can be a respected member of society. You know, I can't think of enough to say. I feel so grateful that some of you think enough of me to ask me to be part of this tonight. And I can assure you that the promises that come on pages 83 and 84 between the description of step 9 and step 10 in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous will actually come true for all of you if you'll just give it a chance. I believe our problem was that we somehow or other lost the God, and somehow or other we find Him in Alcoholics Anonymous. It has been so for me. And that book of Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't tell you you have to do anything. It's written in the past tense. It says this is what we did. And that's the only way us drunks would ever be able to learn anything, is to watch somebody else walk down the path. I can only say this, and I've picked everything I know I've picked up from someone else. But a beautiful man, I heard him say one night, at a talk one night, when he closed, he said, "Thank God for you, and thank you for God." Thank all of you.
My name is Ed Palmquist. I'm a very grateful alcoholic. You know, Earl told my story. I can sit down. It's very difficult to follow that because, you know, he went over the steps and that was mine, and there wasn't anything that he didn't nail down. You know, Dottie said that I can tell somebody else's story. I could always do that. And I can tell Earl's story. So, wow. To get up here after that pitch, that is a hard thing to do. I got sober at the Hole in the Ground in Huntington Park, October the 4th, 1966. And, one of the prerequisites of this little place was that you had to have fun. And fortunately, I've been sober from the day that I come in. or one of the lucky ones. But that prerequisite, I can tell you, has gone the whole way. I mean, I've had a ball here. And I grew up in places like this, and I don't know if some of you know it, but it's a magic place. You come in here, and for some of us drunks, we have to have a place to hide. And I hid in that hole in the ground. And I drew from your guys' strength. Everything that I've learned is from you people. And that means the miserable examples, too. We came up here 2 years ago, not too long ago, Linda. It'll be 2 years in when you guys spoke down in Kingsburg, and Linda, when the first meeting that we went to in Kingsburg, Linda was the guest speaker, and we came in, and she gave us a cordial welcome to this area, and it was really kind of a fun thing. And we went over to Denny's after the meeting, and next thing I saw was about a year later, I became a secretary of the Tuesday night meeting, and by accident, in comes Linda. She got lost, and she brought some of your friends from this area over to Kingsburg. And you know how angels work. I'm almost positive Linda's an angel. So when an angel asks you to come over here, you make sure you do what angels tell you to do. And oh God, I hope I didn't blow it. Is it? I can't believe this. She brought Chainsaw Mama. This isn't it. I can't believe this. I can't believe it. I would blow that. I guess I'm not supposed to. She brought Chainsaw Mama, which is rolling over. So I called my sponsor, and I got a couple of the names of, you know, from the hole in the ground. It was Nancy Nurse and Chainsaw Mama. This was Rolene. So, you know, I had to get some of them that Duke Carson, who was down at the hole in the ground, who was the Chinese smuggler. He was a member of the Purple Gang in Detroit, and this is where I came from. They had the rubber merchant, which was Ray Tenori, and he stole garden hoses for a jug. We had Montana Red. He gave he had a step house in Downey, and he gave a gal that came in here years ago before these houses that you go to, they would try to help people with formaldehyde, and he gave her some and she died. And they put him in jail for a little while, and we got him out. We had Chicken Legged Florence, Blonde Mary, Ice Box Betty, Step and Fetch It. I mean, each one of these has a story, too. Bob the Cook, Kitchen Howard, Wino Kenny, Whiskey Bill, Jittery Jeff, Mousetrap Johnny, Alabama for Others. She was from North Hollywood. I know some of you know her, maybe. Tinkerbell, Twinkle Toes. Then when we started this club down south, we had Penny Pearl, Penny Puppet, Original Penny, Long Nose Penny, Blonde Sandy, One-Eyed Sandy. She took a gun to her eye, blew her eye out, and still lived. She hung in there pretty well. Mailman Pete, Intellectual Pete, Stockbroker Pete, Dirty Pete, Big John, Big Howard, Big Ed, and Baseball Ed. And these are just some of the names of the drunks from down south, you know, to go along with what you had down there. But anyway, this is, you know, each one of these people had a story. Duke Carson, Al Marino, different people that you're talking about. I mean, these were blessed people. Chuck Chamberlain, you heard about Chuck. You know, you guys are young in here, and these people were the people who paved the way for Alcoholics Anonymous today. And it's just fun to be a part of it. Earl kind of told my story, so it makes it a little shaky up here to get up here when he gets into recovery. But the thing that I do know when I look at you guys, I know who you are. I know that there's somebody in this room here today. You know, you guys look pretty spiffy that, you were lonely. And I know that there was somebody in here today that was depressed. And I know there was somebody in this room here today that thought about killing themselves. I know there's somebody in this room right here that is, you know, has gone through anger because, as Earl said, this is part of the ism of alcoholism. And the thing that we do have, we have the steps that can turn these different things around into a positive part of our lives that helps us to recover. And the one thing that we all have together in being in this group is unity. You know, we have this going for ourselves. It's for a drunk, for some of us to go into church, we're not going to be comfortable. But we come into these rooms and, we're automatically comfortable. And it's because of, just for kicks, we heard that the last two speakers have been in jail. Has anybody else been in jail here? Just raise your hand. I mean, you guys haven't been in jail over there? You haven't been in jail? No, my wife hadn't been in jail either. This is something. I can't believe this. Today. Well, you guys, is anybody in here alive? Boy, I know you guys are full of, because every hand's got to come up here. You know, there are a lot of things that we have in common. And when we're sitting in here with our masks and everybody looks spiffy, everybody isn't as spiffy as they look. And when we're sitting in here, and a lot of people don't come into Alcoholics Anonymous unless they're, they have one of these things going for themselves. A lot of times, I try to come into a meeting whether I'm up or I'm down, and if I'm working the steps most of the time, I'm up. But, I've been sober a long time, and I don't know what I'd do out on the bricks if I didn't have these steps. And I don't know what I would do out in the bricks today if I didn't have you people. I know that sounds funny. But the thing that I can do right now, when all else fails, I can go find myself another drunk. And it works. If I'm sitting there and I start getting any of the isms and I don't want to suffer anymore, I can go and I can dig down into the steps and I can recover my... with the help of the God that you guys have showed me. So the thing that we have going for ourselves today, we do have a program, and if we are sitting in here and in this room, we're pretty doggone lucky. This is my wife down here, Jeannie, and we were in San Clemente, and I know she doesn't want to stand up. Usually she shares a pitch for me. And we started a little club in 1975 down in San Clemente. And this, I'll go over this before I sit down, and because this was truly my real spiritual awakening as far as Alcoholics Anonymous is concerned. I grew up in places like this. I've been part of a board. And when we started this, it was Jeannie's idea because she kind of grew up in the nest in the valley, and I got sober at the hole in the ground and then migrated over to Radford Street, which is the actors group, and then Temple City, which was, it was kind of like an Alano club, except there weren't any dues in two of them. And so this was my life. You guys, these places saved me. I think even in the place in Santa Barbara, there was a hole in the ground or over there. that came over there for a while. I don't know if he was there when you got sober, but he left over the hole in the ground, went to Santa Barbara, into that Alano Club in about 70, and I hope he was still there a little bit later. And when we got there, Jeannie said, you know, there were only two meetings, and nobody was friendly. And they said, you know, we really need a place down there. And, you know, I had been involved with a board, and I know how much work one of these places are, and I wasn't ready to make that kind of a challenge. And Jeannie kept it up, and then, lo and behold, everybody jumped on Jeannie. Everybody really nailed her, and because the Laguna AA place didn't want us. Nobody wanted us there, and it seemed like the AA community didn't want a place. So finally, this one fella, and by the way, he got drunk after 29 years, I think with a resentment against what we were doing, read a long version of the traditions telling us not to do it, and then jumped all over at this place afterwards at the brig. And at the next meeting, I got up just like I did right now, and I said, hey, we're going to have a clubhouse. We're going to have it. So we collected $100, and there was a house of ill repute on top of a drugstore. I walked over and rented those places for the $100 for 1 month, and that 1 month turned into 2 months, and we got money from I don't know where. And now if you're ever in San Clemente, I want you to go down to this place and see what this $100 turned into. It's a magnificent place right off the ocean. I know one day we'll get kicked out of there too, but you know, that's the way it is. And we got spit out of this place at the top of the where our little place was, and we got spit into a place between a crap, you know, where they dump the well, I don't know what they call it, and a junkyard, and that's where this AA place was. And when we got in there, the AA community didn't want us, the city didn't want us, nobody wanted us, and all of a sudden, things turned. And now the city of San Clemente are very glad we're there because we took so many people off the streets. And also, the client, you know, the people want an Alano Club, you know, to move into. If one of these places are there and the AA is good, the AA community will come in, and they'll come into a place like this just because you guys are here. So for some of us, these are fantastic. I happen to be one of them. But there's also the people who hate the clubs. You know, and I hate clubs. I hate clubs. But they saved my life. I still hate clubs. And, you know, that's the other part of AA. But, you know, we got to pray for those people. There's magic in these rooms. I just want to let you know that. And the unity and the fun that can be had right here in these places is fantastic for some of us. And I happen to be one. What I'd like to do now is, because Earl told my whole story, I would like for 5 minutes, if anybody has any questions that they'd like to ask about any of the steps, if I can't answer them, I'll get Earl to answer them or Wanda. Is there anybody with any questions right now that they'd like to ask about any steps or anything that's, no questions? All right, I'm going to close with one of Duke's little stories. It's about the three little rabbits. It was foot, 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 and foot, foot, foot. Foot, foot said to foot, 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 if foot doesn't stop drinking, he's going to die. And foot died. And foot, foot, and foot, foot, foot buried foot. And foot, foot said to foot, 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 if foot, with 1 foot in the grave, we better join AA. That's the first time I ever blew this. Thank you very much.